Live from Cap Radio here in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. More than 10 million women and men experience violence from an intimate partner each year. That's according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Now, new research finds incidents of domestic violence and abuse have spiked in the U.S. during the pandemic's lockdown orders. And advocates and experts say it's a crisis that's only getting worse. Today, we're talking about how this abuse has thrived during COVID-19 and how it's being addressed. We'll speak with the Sacramento District Attorney's Domestic Violence Unit about how it's adapted during lockdown orders to help survivors and why domestic violence and attempted strangulations are on the rise in Sacramento County. A new global study also shows domestic violence organizations are struggling to maintain amid increased demand. The California Partnership to End Domestic Violence joins us to talk about it. And we'll take a look at the legal challenges for survivors and how the legal system can better address the rise in expected cases. But first, we're joined by USA Today's National Housing and Social Services reporter, Romina Ruiz Goyriena. She recently wrote about how the $1.9 trillion federal stimulus bill could help women and children leave abusers and why domestic violence rose after pandemic lockdowns. Welcome to Insight, Romina.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so the stimulus bill was approved not that long ago. The third round of checks, some have already started hitting bank accounts. Tell us how it could help women and children leave their abusers.
Well, in terms of the $1.9 trillion stimulus, there's about $24 billion that is being used to stabilize the childcare industry. We saw in this pandemic that the majority of the job losses we have is in particular affecting women. We haven't seen these levels of female unemployment since around 1948. And the bill also has approximately $450 million for domestic violence services. And what experts have told me and what we found in the reporting is that there's often an intersection, right? In order, we saw that because of the lockdowns and the shutdowns and all of these stuff, like people were in their homes with their abusers. And at the same time, this job loss, you know, there is an aspect of economic violence that survivors are often in the cycle of or in the throes of, and without childcare, it's really impossible to get a job, especially as they become single parents. This is what the research says and what experts told me.
Mm-hmm. So we've got that $24 billion to stabilize the childcare industry, $450 million you mentioned for domestic violence services. Who led the initiative to include all of this in the stimulus?
Well, I would say that there's different parts were led by different senators, but Murray of Washington State, Senator Murray was a big proponent both of stabilizing the child care, and this has been an issue that she feels very passionate about, and also domestic violence services. She has been a long time. She has introduced bills in the past. And what she told me is that, you know, lack of access to childcare should not be the reason why survivors or victims stay with a violent partner.
Mm-hmm. Data shows that domestic violence and abuse has spiked during the pandemic. COVID-19 has made it harder for survivors to seek out help. Give us a better sense of why the pandemic has exacerbated this violence and abuse.
Well, I would say that in part, the research tells us that whenever there are moments of economic downturn, violence spikes. But at the same time, all of the natural outlets where survivors would look for supportive services, whether it was putting their kids in school and taking them to school every day, or it was regular doctor's visits, or going to churches, like all of these things have now gone online. And, you know, often the victims are living in very, very close quarters with their abusers. It you know, we have also seen reports of cyber stalking from abusers of victims also. So people are just not showing up to doctors' appointments. You know, they're not even, one of the doctors that I spoke to even told me that they're not even showing up for their telehealth appointments because they can't really speak freely and they can't, you know, do any of the monitoring. So basically all of the mechanisms for screening and all of the mechanisms in order to get people help, whether they're ready or not to leave the abusive home, has sort of been stopped in its tracks.
Do we have any sense of the money that's included in the stimulus, the type of impact that it will have for those suffering from domestic violence and abuse?
I mean, I think, you know, I can tell you that what the reporting thus far shows is that these are services that are needed. You know, I got calls from dozens of women from undisclosed shelters and locations who said, you know, they really needed this help. There's a part of it that is supposed to go through to increasing subsidies and subsidized childcare. There's been like 4.5 million childcare slots that just vanished from one day to the next. Mm. So increasing capacity is an issue. And you know, I think there's that. But I still think that it's too early to tell. Exactly. You know, I think it offers an opportunity, and this is what the women have told me. I think that's what the experts have told me, but, you know, only time will tell.
Romina, what's the reception been like regarding this cash infusion by advocates? What are advocates happy with the amount?
I think it depends on who you ask, right? I think I have written, you know, I follow social services and I speak to low-income people every day. I, you know, many of the subjects of my stories have said that this stimulus money is a godsend, but people are still very behind on a whole bunch of bills, right? They have either gone into debt. They have, if they have 401ks, in many instances, they've cashed them out. Advocates that some of analysts that I have spoken to, like, they applaud these efforts and are speaking again about a fourth round of stimulus. So it just really depends.
You wrote about one woman in particular with Community Change Action who says Congress needs to invest an additional $100 billion long term to stabilize the child care industry along these lines.
Right, exactly. So I just think... yeah, I think it depends on you know, which policy think tank you ask. I think that they're lauding and they applaud these efforts. But until we see the rollout and we see, you know, and we're able to report on who had access, who didn't, who fell through the cracks, as is often the case with these big rollouts. I mean, there are people that are still waiting for their second stimulus check that have reported that they haven't received it. So. Mm. It also depends on how it's going to be executed by the childcare industry. We saw last year with PPP just gaps, right? That would be the best way to call it, gaps in people that applied and how they executed and whether they paid staff or not. So we'll just have to see.
Yeah, you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're speaking with USA Today National Housing and Social Services reporter Romina Ruiz Goiriena about how the new federal stimulus bill could help women and children leave abusers and why domestic violence rose after pandemic lockdown orders were put in place. Romina, you wrote about 35-year-old Lindsay McAndrew of Orlando, Florida. Tell us about her and why her story matters in the context of this conversation.
Well, Lindsay is a woman who has been married for about a decade. And, you know, she decided very bravely, I would say, as she's in the middle of a custody battle. And I do want to say that there are a lot of victims that, although they called and they spoke to me, they didn't feel comfortable, you know, going on the record and you know, outing, giving their full name. So I do want to say that Lindsay was incredibly brave to talk about the situation of domestic violence that she had for over a decade. She actually had made plans in 2019 to leave her abuser, to flee. And all of a sudden, you know, the pandemic hits early on in 2020. And with the stay-at-home orders and with her kids being out of school or just everything, she has to stay home, right? And what happened is that the episodes of violence increased over time, and she couldn't take it anymore. And she made a plan and drove to her parents' house, to her mother's house in New Jersey. She made the plan, retained an attorney. Her husband was served divorce papers. He did not contest the divorce. However, they are in the throes of a custody battle, in which case the judge ordered her back to Florida, and she had to go into the home with her abuser, and the kids were not allowed to leave the home until she found a permanent stay. So she was able to tap into friends and family, to her dad, in order to get an apartment. But she has a job, but the childcare part is just too expensive. It's absolutely too expensive. So whatever she's making, it's not enough to cover the bills and cover the rent and pay to become financially independent. So she's kind of in this, this cycle, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And here's a person who was fortunate to have the resources of people who could help her, like, for instance, with the apartment. But this childcare issue is such a huge part of it, right? You wrote that experts say it might be the main key in breaking the economic cycle of violence. And you did speak with women from undisclosed shelters and locations who just said they couldn't leave their children alone to look for a job or, to get out of this situation. So give us a little more insight into that.
Right. So I think what, as other experts have said throughout this entire pandemic, COVID-19 compounded things that we knew, issues we already knew were pervasive in this country. And so, if kids are not in school, then there's no ability to leave or to exit either the home or the shelter to look for a job, right? And conversely, once you find a job, if all of a sudden the only way that you can keep a job is doing a night shift or doing weekends where there aren't any daycare centers or there aren't any providers, then all of a sudden you can't, you're going to make minimum wage, but what you're going to have in take home pay is going to be less than the cost of this childcare. So you're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
Is what these victims sort of say. Like, I'm basically trying, I have to make an impossible choice. And it's a nonsensical choice in many ways. That's what, these women told me. What experts have said is, we often think about leaving. I think when I report on issues of gender-based violence and I speak to survivors, their sentiment is, people always want you to leave. And there are more questions once you actually leave the abuse of what may happen. People think of securing housing, but they don't think about the fact that, as one expert told me in the story, that economic violence or alienating the person from their professional trajectory starts very on in the abuse, so that the only job that they can often get is a minimum wage job, right? So then you're sort of dealing with the wreckage and the after effects, the aftershocks of the abuse for a very, very long time. And women have said that they don't feel supported, that they don't have all of the tools in their toolkit. And it'll be something like childcare that is often overlooked in the equation.
Yeah. Romina, what about any additional help or federal legislation that may be on the way, perhaps a way to educate these women so that they, when they come out of these situations, they do have better options than a minimum wage job?
Well, that I know of, thus far, there has been actions in terms of the expansion of the Violence Against Women Act. But I still think that, to my knowledge, I'm not aware of any bills that are being introduced right now about further job training or placements or any of these things that would tackle kind of the real challenges that they face every day.
Yeah. Romina Ruiz Goiriena is a national housing and social services reporter for USA Today. Great piece. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your what you found with us.
Thank you so much.
So up next, we'll speak with the Assistant Chief Deputy District Attorney for the Sacramento District Attorney's Domestic Violence Unit, Dawn Blade, about how her office has adapted during lockdown orders to help survivors and why domestic violence and attempted strangulations are on the rise in Sacramento County. If you or someone you know has or is experiencing domestic violence or abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline. It's 1-800-799-7233, 799-7233, or visit thehotline.org. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, and we're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. We are talking about the rise in domestic abuse during the pandemic, what's being done about it, and the challenges in helping survivors during this period. Local authorities, advocacy organizations, and service providers throughout the region are working increasingly hard to respond to a crisis that has spiked following COVID-19 lockdowns. According to a new analysis by the National Commission on COVID-19 and Criminal Justice, domestic violence incidents have risen in the U.S. by nearly 10% since the pandemic began. And experts and advocates say the problem is still much worse than the data suggests, as a lack of privacy has subjected many survivors to closer surveillance by their abuser, making it difficult to call a crisis hotline or law enforcement for help. In Sacramento County, domestic abuse isn't just on the rise, it's getting more violent. Dawn Blade is the Assistant Chief Deputy District Attorney for the Sacramento District Attorney's Domestic Violence Unit, and she joins us now with some insight into this. Welcome to Insight, Dawn. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Assistant Chief Deputy, how soon into the pandemic did you or your unit recognize that domestic violence and abuse victims were in a much more vulnerable place?
It was very early on in the initial shutdown that I think we all were experiencing the isolation and realizing how hard it was on our own home situations. And then when you think about the more vulnerable population, where they are now trapped potentially against their will because of shutdown orders in a home with an abuser, it's the worst possible scenario where you've got an increase in tension, increase oftentimes we saw with substance abuse, mental health issues being heightened, tension in the homes. It was a disaster for both proximity to the victim and the abuser and also the external forces on the home and on individuals. So we tried to do as much as possible right away to make sure that we were still providing services, making calls when we saw cases come across our office desks, making sure people had protective orders. It's just that there was a difficulty of protective orders or move out orders, things like that, when nobody was leaving their homes. So oftentimes these individuals were trapped in a place where they couldn't, but we did what we could to do safety planning with our victim advocates, to make sure that we were making all of the appropriate arguments in court to keep offenders who should be in custody for dangerousness reasons in custody, and do as much as we could in terms of outreach. Amory Schubert right away started doing podcasts, doing public service announcements. And then we partnered with Raley's and the Grocers Association, put out flyers that could be distributed and posted in multiple languages, giving resource numbers and places to call, hoping that that would provide some kind of lifeline to these individuals.
Yeah, that seems strategic to have it there in the grocery store, because it's one of the activities that, at least in the early stages of the pandemic, was maybe the only chance someone had to get out of the house was to go secure some groceries.
Exactly. That was the intent behind that plan.
Tell us a little bit about your unit, how it was developed, how it operates, and then you mentioned some of the services that you provide, but if you could just give us a little understanding of that.
So our office has always been very proactive when it comes to intimate partner violence, and we've had a domestic violence unit for as long as I can remember, and I've been with the office for over 25 years. My bureau now, interestingly, what Amory has done has included in my bureau both domestic violence, child abuse, adult sexual assault, human trafficking, elder abuse, because we realize the interplay of those types of violence. Domestic violence doesn't just affect the offender and the survivor. It affects, of course, children in the home. And oftentimes there's combinations of these types of abuse. So that's all under one umbrella right now. And the unit has assigned and dedicated specialized victim advocates. The victim advocates are trained with safety planning, with danger assessments, determining what kind of level of danger a survivor is in the relationship. We do outreach to all of those individuals, whether they want prosecution or not. We make sure that they're safe, and we provide resources and referrals to them and maintain contact with them. And we did that throughout the pandemic. It just was more virtual than the in-person meetings that we like to have.
Yeah, I'm wondering how COVID-19 complicates the tasks that you're trying to do, the help that you're trying to put out there.
I think the difficulty is, as you recognize from some of the earlier discussion, is the access to technology. A lot of folks don't have the access to technology, and they don't have the privacy to use it if their abuser is in the house with them. So one of the things that we made sure was put out there during one of our podcasts was that you could even text 911. And so that you, and you could message the different law enforcement agencies and the different community partners who help in this area, so that maybe that would be something you could do in secret and not be concerned about whether or not your abuser could hear you or know what you were saying. So that's definitely been a barrier because people aren't being seen by their neighbors, their the teachers, the one of the reasons and ways that domestic violence comes to light is because people ask questions. So we were trying to encourage people to, you know, keep in touch with their family and their friends and their neighbors. And if you see something, say something, because it shouldn't be behind closed doors.
Yeah. Has the texting plan, has that worked?
Yes, that has been a means that people have been able to communicate. I don't have the information from dispatch from the local law enforcement in terms of numbers, but that's something that I think a lot of folks didn't even realize was an option.
Yeah. Mm. We know domestic violence and attempted strangulations specifically are on the rise in Sacramento County. And you spoke about it in a presentation to the Board of Supervisors last month. Tell us a bit about that.
I did. Together with Weave and our Family Justice Center, we did a presentation to the board kind of on what we've seen in terms of how COVID has impacted intimate partner domestic violence. And strangulation and the severity of the abuse is one of the characteristics that we've seen. The cases coming across our office had been severe in terms of the kind of conduct, the amount of abuse. We also were seeing an increased level of strangulation involved in these cases. The reason that that's so concerning is strangulation is a very high predictor of the offender committing more significant violence. There is a tie to the use of strangulation. There's a tie to law enforcement involved shootings. If you look at the individuals who've been involved in those cases, a very high percentage have had strangulation in their history. It's the thought process that goes on with an abuser that you are holding control of another person's life. You have their breath, their blood flow literally in your hands, and you're letting your victim know, I can choose to kill you or not. And so not only is it mentally a significant and dangerous aspect for both the victim or and the offender's perpetration of violence, but it's also medically very concerning. A lot of times in the past, we didn't realize that if we didn't see bruises, people thought strangulation didn't happen. You know, where's the scratches? Where's the bruises?
Oh, right.
But studies have shown that less than 50% of cases of strangulation even show any outward injury. So what you have to do is ask the right questions, because there can be internal injury. There can be loss of consciousness. There can be blood clots and strokes. And there's a lot of significant medical concerns for someone who's experienced strangulation. So part of that presentation to the board was letting them know that we've there's a number of interdisciplinary partners in law enforcement and our community partners and health partners who've adopted this strangulation protocol. And we're urging all of those agencies to not only use the type of questioning to make sure that we're getting the right information, but then also getting people to the medical intervention that we need that isn't always done. So that's part of what the presentation was about. The board was very receptive. They clearly want to do a lot in this area and we're concerned about the numbers and the information. So we're working with them to come up with language for an ordinance that will mandate this type of inquiry if there's reason to believe that there's strangulation.
Yeah. Domestic violence criminal cases referred to the DA's office decreased last year just by a little bit, but during a period when we have evidence to show that these cases are actually on the rise, a decrease sort of runs counter to that. What do you make of it? Is the disparity likely a sign that domestic violence incidents are just not being reported to the police because of the pandemic?
Yes. And we've seen that also in child abuse. And I think it's because of the isolation that individuals who are experiencing this type of violence are having during the pandemic when they don't necessarily have access to reporting to law enforcement. So we believe it's increased because we know that from the numbers from Family Justice Center and from Weave, that they're going to the community partners, their numbers are increasing, but they're not necessarily being reported to law enforcement. And why that is, I don't know. What I could guess is we've also seen in the last year a lot of social issues happening at the same time in Sacramento. Mm. And not only were law enforcement involved in security issues downtown, and there were a number of protests and concerns, and I don't know if that led to some of the lack of going to law enforcement to report these crimes, but we certainly need to look at that and make sure that we're doing all we can to intervene in a way that is best for survivors and for the community.
Finally, do I understand that the cases are backlogged right now?
We do have a backlog of cases, which was inevitable given the court shutdown, but we have been leaders, not just statewide, but nationally, in terms of the number of cases we've continued to try. We've been doing trials throughout the pandemic, except when the court was completely closed, and we're doing more than most. So we're trying to do everything we can to get through the backlog, to go through cases, identify which ones we can protect both the victim and the community, and come up with solutions to intervene in a way that hopefully will prevent an offender from reoffending. So we're doing our best to get through and look at these cases and get them through the system. We've been working throughout, and we'll just kind of have to take it one day at a time and see where we are 6 months from now.
Yeah, well, best of luck on that front. Don Blade is the Assistant Chief Deputy District Attorney for the Sacramento District Attorney's Domestic Violence Unit. Thank you so much for sharing that information with us today.
Sure, no problem. Thank you very much.
According to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, one third of women and one quarter of men in California will experience intimate partner violence in their lifetime. And all too often, survivors struggle to access the services and care they need to escape their abuser and then establish a life on their own. Experts say it's an issue that has only gotten worse and has gone underreported since the pandemic began a year ago. Advocates are also struggling to provide the needed help, with nearly 70% of care providers saying in a new global study conducted by the organization No More that demand for these services has dramatically increased. Jackie Marroquin is the director of programs for the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence, and she joins us now with a little more on this. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. First, before we start, tell us, for those who don't know, what the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence is and what it does.
Sure. We are the federally recognized domestic violence coalition in California. And what that means is that we are actually a member organization. So domestic violence organizations throughout California are our members, and we do work on behalf of our members and on behalf of survivors and families across California, both here at the state level and at the federal level as well.
So let's talk about how your organization has been impacted by the pandemic. Have you had to adjust how you help people suffering from this issue?
We have, and actually we don't provide, while we do not provide services to domestic violence survivors, our organization was impacted by COVID just like so many other organizations out there. As we speak right now, everyone is still working from home. I don't know if we're going to be going back to the office anytime soon. All of our events, we do a lot of training and technical assistance for local domestic violence programs and service providers. And all of that is happening virtually. We're not expecting to go back to in-person events anytime soon either. But yeah, we've definitely seen the impact for local providers across the state. I think something that we keep hearing over and over again is this overwhelming fatigue that service providers are in fact experiencing. Part of it has to do with the fact that this kind of work, working directly with survivors, is already hard, right? In the best of circumstances, a survivor who leaves in an abusive relationship or is looking for help while in an abusive relationship, there's already so many options, right? There are so many options for the survivor to reach out for help. One of the important things about domestic violence, and I think your previous guest mentioned this, is that isolation is the biggest tool, right, for somebody who is causing harm. And in this pandemic, the safest thing that we can do is actually isolate.
Yeah.
So there's a contradiction there, right, that we're talking about folks who medically, if you want to stay safe, if you want to stay healthy, if you want to keep your family healthy, your community healthy, you stay home. That's exactly one of the strategies and one of the tools that people who use abuse utilize in order to keep someone under their power and control. And so these organizations have not closed since the pandemic began. And so there's this, you know, there's sort of like a stacking on of different things. So one is the pandemic. Two is, you know, we've had a series of like natural disasters all across the state that have also impacted folks who are working in domestic violence organizations. And so what we forget sometimes is that the same things that the survivors are experiencing, so are the service providers, right? Service providers are also worried about keeping their families safe, keeping their families healthy, and also keeping their jobs. And so it's been sort of like an overwhelming, you know, avalanche of just things that local programs have had to deal with. I will say that local programs have also innovated. There are so many things. Innovation in this field has really accelerated as a result of the pandemic, which is a great thing. And folks are also just tired, right? Folks just, you know, we're also dealing with the same trauma, this collective trauma around the pandemic. So there's that, that's starting to be more and more concerning to local programs.
I'm wondering about getting around that isolation issue, because it does seem to be the central problem during this pandemic. And the previous guest mentioned what I thought was a clever way to partner with a local grocery store chain to get that information to one of the few places people were visiting during the peak of the pandemic. What other sort of routes have you heard that you found were creative ways to get around that isolation?
Yeah, I think I've heard very similar things. You know, local programs really investing in texting, being able to text with survivors, being able to have, you know, conversations. You know, I've heard of folks saying, you know, the survivor goes out for a walk with their children around the block. And sometimes that's the only time where they might be able to, you know, actually speak to someone on the phone. But most of it is because I think technology has really opened the door for folks to be able to, who otherwise might not have reached out for help, for folks to reach out for help because of that, you know, that access to technology. Although I will also admit that there's a lot of lack of access to technology as well that could also provide some avenues for connection. And so, you know, there's all of those issues that we need to take into account as we are thinking about ways in which survivors can and want to connect. And really, really, you know, meeting survivors where they are. Yeah. And right now, survivors are at home.
Jackie, your organization has a lot of data, does it not? Like, it's... You look at the who's being affected, who's causing the problem, those sorts of things. How does California stack up in terms of nationwide?
Well, I think the California numbers really do mirror what's happening nationally. I think the vast increase in the request for services is something that we have experienced as well. It was interesting because at the very beginning of the pandemic, we saw local programs reported a dip in folks reaching out for assistance. And I think in my analysis, it's more about, you know, folks just figuring out what was next. You know, we had suddenly gone into sheltering in place and folks were just trying to figure out what is happening in the world. And as soon as we were able to figure that out, then all of the calls started, you know, really coming in, and all of the requests for services were really present. You know, I think there is definitely a higher level of abuse as well that folks are experiencing. And so higher level of not only physical abuse, but also psychological abuse, financial abuse, particularly with the stimulus money that's coming. And we know that there's, you know, going to be an influx of funds coming into the states, coming into our communities, and also coming into homes. And so that's also another concern of financial abuse that is occurring within a violent relationship or an abusive relationship. Whereas, you know, we think, oh, everyone's getting a, you know, stimulus check for $1,400. That might not be the case for a survivor, because especially if they're married or if they're doing joint taxes, that money is going to go to possibly the person who is harming them, and they won't have access to it. So it's important for us to not make those assumptions that folks are just going to be able to access the money that is coming to them.
Might not be that easy.
And that's just not true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jackie, finally, is there anything we can learn from the demographics? Do you break down the data to that level to something we might find surprising regarding who this is happening to?
No, actually, in terms of demographics, I think that, you know, we know that, you know, domestic violence happens regardless of gender, regardless of socioeconomic status. I think the difference really is whether or not someone has access Let's say, for example, you know, somebody who doesn't have access to getting a restraining order, they would have to go to a social service agency to get help with that. And if somebody does have the means to have that kind of access to do it on their own or to hire an attorney, then I think that makes things a little easier for folks, right? That kind of access to not just information, but access to funds in order to be able to take care of themselves and their families, something that many, many families do not have at this point in time. Mm-hmm. There might have been a year ago pre-pandemic, there might have been some plans, right, for folks to leave, for folks to, you know, separate. But all of those plans have kind of gone by the wayside, because there's also concern with survivors who really don't want the person who's causing them harm to be arrested or to go to jail. There's such uncertainty for survivors right now, for entire families right now, that the thought about calling law enforcement and have someone arrested during a pandemic is concerning, because they're also concerned about whether or not the person who's causing them harm is going to get COVID or get sick in some way. So I think that's also a very real and a very natural a concern for survivors.
Yeah. Jackie Marroquin is the director of programs for the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence. We really appreciate you taking the time to give us a California perspective on this.
Thanks.
Still ahead, the legal challenges for survivors amid more reopenings and how our legal system can better address the rise in domestic violence and abuse cases. Advocates say there will be a big demand as we see more reopenings. And again, if you or someone you know has or is experiencing domestic violence or abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline. It's 1-800-799-7233. Again, 799-7233, or visit thehotline.org. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And this hour, we're talking about domestic abuse and violence during COVID-19 and what's being done to address what the United Nations has referred to as the shadow pandemic. Even apart from COVID-19, many advocates say the legal system's ability to address these problems falls short. We just heard that there was a backlog with one of our previous guests. And getting legal help for survivors has only been more difficult during the pandemic, with the temporary closures of the courts, changes in how courts have to operate, and other challenging issues. Legal experts predict there will be a big demand as we see more loosening of lockdown restrictions. Allison, or Ali Kephart, is the director of legal services for Weave Incorporated, a Sacramento-based crisis intervention center for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking. Ali Kephart joins us now. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
When it comes to rates and incidents of domestic violence and abuse during the pandemic and lockdown orders, what trends have you seen in your legal department?
I think we've seen trends that really mirror the overall trends that are being reported locally and nationally. So we're seeing folks report much higher, even higher rates than normal, of being separated or isolated from services. We're also seeing folks report increases in domestic violence in terms of the intensity of the events that they're experiencing and the frequency. So when we think about domestic violence, we think about it as a cycle, as the cycle of violence. And in each relationship, that cycle looks different and can happen at a different pace. And what I'm kind of consistently seeing across the board is that folks are reporting that this cycle is speeding up. So violent events or abusive events are happening more frequently across the board.
How has Weave adapted as a result of all of this that you're seeing?
Like many other organizations, we kind of had to pivot overnight. I think pivot should be the word of 2020. Yeah. So we basically overnight shifted to remote services. We were really fortunate that we didn't have to discontinue any of our services. Our staff were phenomenal in terms of going home and picking up the work from home. So we've done that in our legal department in particular. And so we continue to have consultations with clients and represent them and attend court proceedings. But it definitely looks a little different.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the court proceedings and just the courts in general. How sluggish has that become?
Now we're back in a better place. At the very beginning of the pandemic, we had about 6 weeks where there were some of the most strict closures in all of our courts across the county. The courts still always were able to accept requests for emergency orders, so emergency domestic violence restraining orders or civil harassment restraining orders or things like that. But I think many folks didn't know that. Just as your previous guest mentioned, there was this period at the beginning of shelter in place where everybody was trying to get their bearings. And because of that, I think there were a group of survivors that didn't reach out for help because they didn't know they could. Since that time, the court has now started to offer almost all of its services, but it is doing them virtually. So there's particularly in the family court where we do domestic violence restraining orders, everything is happening over Zoom, which is good from a public health perspective, but can be very challenging for some survivors, just in terms of accessing technology and being comfortable with it. Making sure they get the information that they need about hearings that are coming, and even being able to access information about how they go about applying for protective orders.
Yeah. Ali, when it comes to the law, how is domestic violence treated differently from other crimes like assault?
Well, it depends. If you're talking about in criminal proceedings, there's a whole host of penal code sections that are specifically related to domestic violence. And so the way those crimes are investigated, the way they're prosecuted by the district attorney's office is going to be different than an assault between two unrelated parties. Mm-hmm. And the potential remedies for that, including protections for the victim. So you're more likely to perhaps see a judge issue something like a criminal protective order, which is very analogous to our family law domestic violence restraining orders, which are in civil court. So they get handled by prosecutors who handle that specific type of case. So they have an understanding of what the dynamic is between a perpetrator and their victim.
We've heard from a few of the guests this morning that sometimes a survivor chooses not to press charges at all. Why might that be the case? What's some of the reasoning there?
That's a really good question. And I think it's something that a lot of people sort of, it fits under that umbrella of the why didn't you leave, or why didn't you, the very victim blaming questions in a lot of ways. But what we know is that, victims have a lot of connections to their perpetrators. And depending on what kind of lived experiences they've had, they may not want to participate in the criminal justice process because they may not want to see the perpetrator go to jail. They may not want to see, they may not want to be involved in criminal justice issues. They may be dependent on the perpetrator economically if the perpetrator is the breadwinner for their family, and then that person goes to jail. They don't have any economic support. Or if they share children with the perpetrator, they may not want to separate their children from that person and interfere with that relationship.
So, Ali, if a survivor did not want to press charges but needed protection, what would you suggest they do?
They have an alternative route through the family court, which is again, civil proceedings, not criminal. And so they can actually apply for their own domestic violence restraining order. And there are a variety of different orders that the court can make to help keep them and other members of their family, including children, safe. They can reach out for services to do that through our organization and a number of others in the community. And there are a lot of really good resources on the Sacramento County Court's website as well.
Yeah. And in just about 30 seconds, legal experts do predict there might be a huge surge of these cases as we lift the lockdowns. Is that what you're expecting?
Absolutely. Yes. I think there's been a lot of people that have been trapped with their perpetrators and they haven't had a safe way to reach out. And once they can, I think we are going to see a lot of folks.
Yeah. Allie Kephart is the director of legal services for Weave Incorporated, a Sacramento-based crisis intervention center for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking. Allie, thank you so much and best of luck moving forward with all of this.
Thank you for having me.
So that is Insight for today. Learn more about our guests and the myriad of services that were mentioned at capradio.org/insight. And again, if you or someone you know has or is experiencing domestic violence or abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline. It's 800-799-7233. Again, 799-7233, or visit thehotline.org. And I'm Randall White. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow when we talk about itching that travel bug that's been building for the past year. We'll hear from experts who explain how the opening of travel markets is expected to evolve, what it means for California, and one area that's seen a 900% increase in travel searches. Make it a great day.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.